Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal Chibchage, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah Dae, recording from home on Thursday, December 2nd, 2021. On tonight's show, my guests. Heather Mall investigates her grandmother's mysterious past in her debut solo dance show, Pomegranate.
I am excited. I'm really looking forward to getting on the stage. But of course, getting on stage and performing, there's always that, what they call, I love the word in French, le trac. I don't even know what it means, really. Stage fright is like really, really literal. But there's just something, you know, where you don't know what it is. It's the unknown still.
Leslie Velasquez performs in Jonathan, A Seagull Parable, a play for kids and teens that combines disabled and non-disabled performers.
The theme of the play talks about that, the differences between us and why we cannot get together to get to an understanding. In working, you got to get an agreement at some point. You have to work.
And dancers Julia B. Laperrière and Sébastien Provencher on learning to dance outside the box.
What are the categories that affect them in their lives, and how also we carry our bodies through these? Like, you know, living in a city, being in cubes the whole day, like what, how does it affect the way we are in our bodies and how we close ourselves?
Before we begin, two stars of the theater are no more. Firstly, of course, Stephen Sondheim, the composer and lyricist, passed away on Friday, aged 91. He actually sat down for a final interview a few days earlier. A 90-minute chat on a Sunday with a reporter at the New York Times came to his home in Roxbury, Connecticut. Michael Paulson said that despite his years, Sondheim showed little signs of being in ill health and that he was, quote, engaged and playfully pugnacious, offering to play songs for a musical he had been working on for years but hadn't completed yet. Sondheim was possibly the biggest name in musical theater in the latter half of the 20th century. He was born in New York in 1930, and he would go on to write the lyrics for Gypsy and West Side Story, and also the big shows Sweeney Todd, Into the Woods, and Sunday at the Park with George are some of his works. He won 8 Tony Awards, including a Lifetime Achievement Award in 2008. Steven Spielberg's much-anticipated adaptation of West Side Story comes out later this month. And closer to home, Mary Claire Blais, poet, novelist, and playwright, died this week at age 82 at her home in Key West, Florida. She was born in Quebec City in 1939 and published her first work at just 20 years old. It was called La Belle Bête. Her best-known work, though, was Une Saison de la Vie d'Emmanuel, about a young boy who was growing up in a large rural family. Mary Claire herself grew up in a family of modest means. That novel was published in over 10 languages. It brought her fame and awards, though Mary Claire often shunned the limelight. She also wrote 6 plays and several collections of poetry. Mary Claire Blais, Quebec writer, dead at 82. Heather Ma has been on the trail of her grandmother Ma for years, a mysterious woman who was born in China in 1895 and who later came to Canada as a very young woman, eventually becoming a second wife to the family she traveled with. Heather's show, Pomegranate, is both an imagining of her grandmother's cross-Pacific journey in life, but also an homage to migration, family, and suffering, as well as resilience, fertility, and beauty. If this all sounds familiar, I did speak here with Heather last fall when she was planning to put on this show at the Mai, only it was canceled last minute because of encroaching COVID restrictions. In all, the show was canceled twice, but it's coming back on tonight. However, the past year has actually given Heather a chance to learn even more about her grandmother and deepen her work on Pomegranate. While last year's performances did kind of go on as planned, as she will explain to you, this weekend marks her solo debut as a dancer at the age of 60, a fascinating move in a career that prizes youth and is inherently very hard on the body. Heather is not only a trained dancer who has worked with the likes of Marie Chouinard and Gilles Mahou, but she also studied psychology, coaching, martial arts, and yoga. You'll hear just how well-rounded and curious she is in just a moment. Pomegranate opens in less than an hour from now at the Mai, but you will have a chance to see it Friday and Saturday if you like, including a remarkable new way for patrons who are partially sighted or blind to take in dance. I spoke with Heather Ma last week. Welcome back to Upstage, Heather. Thank you so much for being here. It's been a year since we last spoke.
It's a pleasure, Sarah. Pleasure to meet you again.
So let's start from the beginning. Let's just reconnect with the story of your grandmother, the story that's kind of like the bones of what, you know, this bigger story about migration and family that you're telling. Tell us about her.
The story began when I was in the studio and I was just playing around, and I had often been throughout my life wondering who my grandmother was. I never met her. She died before I was born. I live in Montreal. Most of my Chinese family, my father's family, are all on the West Coast in Vancouver, literally all of them, I believe. There was one in Alberta, but anyways, they're all over there. So growing up, and we didn't go out there very much until I was much older, so I never really knew, and my father would give little tidbits. I just always had a curiosity about her. I had read some stories that my father, a few chapters he had written that he never published. I was very curious. So there were some memories about her in China. What I did know was that when the grandfather, my grandfather, my father's father died, they were in Prince Rupert and they had to bring the body back after 1 year to the village to bury him there. What I should say is my grandmother, and I believe I can say it now because my cousins have said it, there were two wives, which is very common in those days in the Chinese culture. So I think there is a stigma sometimes when you say that around polygamy, but it's a culture where it was quite common, and often the wives did get along well. So my grandfather had a first wife, and my grandmother at the age of 15 was employed by the first wife as her servant. I've never said this last year because it's come out to the open and I didn't want to make any waves with the family. So she was the servant girl, and I actually this summer found the documents, handwritten, the Canadian immigration documents of the day she came through, came off the boat, and she had taken on the name of Ma already, and she came over as the daughter, but she was the servant of 14 or 15 of the first wife. So they lived in Vancouver in Prince Rupert, BC. Over time, my grandmother matured and my grandfather married her. When the grandfather died, as I said, I think the first family had already gone back to China to take care of the house, the village there. Maybe two wives was a little something to manage. And so my grandmother and most of the family left Vancouver to go back to the village. I think the eldest son, son number one of the first wife, managed the businesses in Prince Rupert. So the story that I had believed was war broke out. It was 1937. They were already under civil war when they went there. So it was a very difficult time. Everyone who knows that history has told me it was not a beautiful place to be. So they went back there and they never got out. My father got out and he went back to rescue his sister, I think two sisters. He didn't manage to get my grandmother out. That's as much as I knew of the story. So I always believed she had died there after the war. I found out this summer that the family did go and get her and brought her back after the war. And she's buried in Vancouver.
Wow.
So that's a really interesting story. However, Pomegranate was inspired by the mystery of the story. And so I extended it into imagining the boat voyage of a young girl. I imagine first there is a prologue and then I get into the story. So the prologue for me is more the mystery and the imaginings. And then once we get into the story, I travel back and forth through imagining in the embodiment of a young girl, you know, there's so many emotions. I think all of these people that we can see on the news, or if ever we've gone over to work with them, people that are in the migratory situation, the refugees, there's so much strength, so much courage, so much resourcefulness, pain. And I imagine there must be joy. There has to be joy. That's part of survival, right? I just really built a life into all that experience. So it goes beyond my grandmother, because actually, as I said, I didn't have an actual story, but I imagine all these things and, you know, visiting photo exhibits of refugees, people in camps. My grandmother didn't live that, but I think living in the village during the war must have been similar, starvation, very insecure situations.
I'm speaking with Heather Ma, the choreographer and the performer, getting ready to present Pomegranate at the Mai. So it's important to know, of course, that when you and I spoke last year, you were about to put the show on and it got canceled because of what happened. But it's still, the show went on, but in a different way. We'll get to that in a moment. Now, you were just talking about, you know, the fact that your show was kind of addressing the mystery of your ancestor, your grandmother. A lot of us, you know, have those unwritten or like unknowns about our family past. But in the intervening year, you've learned all this about her, these little details. So does your relation to the story, to the performance change at all because you now kind of have these clarifications to her story?
It's changed a lot in my own experience of my family history, in my processing it. However, in the dancing of Pomegranate, is I realized that this story's taken on a life of its own, as any creation we do often does. So I can say that I feel a little more strength knowing the results of the end of her life, but it hasn't changed anything about the choreography and the performing of it, except that, as I said, I feel a little more settled in it. And that could be because it's been worked a little bit more without too many changes, and also because of this new knowledge.
It's settled a bit more into your bones.
Yes.
So you did end up doing some performances. The rules had changed last fall. Live performances were basically put on hold, but you got around it. You had very tiny audiences. Is that right?
Yeah, it wasn't actually officially an audience.
Right.
What we did do was invited five people per night over four or five performances. I think we did five. And yes, we did five. And so we sent out invitations to five people to, as we can say, witness the running through of the show. However, the way that we did it is we had a residency, so we got everything up and running. We didn't know if we were going to go on or not. Last year, you and I talked about that. And so we had switched the whole schedule around. Originally, we were going to do 2 weeks of residency and get ready for a show. Then we realized it probably wouldn't open. So we did 1 week of residency. And then we decided to do 1 week of invitations in case it didn't open. And it did not. So we were ready to roll. So the production is up and running. All the lights were set. So every night that we did for those five people was it was a full show without an official audience.
Did that make up for some of the disappointment that you were no doubt experiencing?
Completely. I shouldn't say completely. But yes, it was a really great experience. I felt, I have to say, it took a lot more inner energy, the tension, but that's something we've all been going through. People working on Zoom, going in an office or not, they may have enjoyed it or not, but at times it's stressful. So it was just there was a little more stress. I was really, really tired at the end. But as far as going in and doing the show, no, it was a gift.
I'm speaking with Heather Ma, who is the performer and choreographer behind Pomegranate. It is her debut solo show, which is a big deal. And now you're going to get it to perform it in front of a real audience. So how do you feel, a year later, finally get to have, real ticket holders coming into the room and you're getting to put on this really meaningful show for them?
Stage fright?
Naturally.
That does not go away. So everyone says, you know, when I say, oh, I'm stressed, and they say, you know, good, excited, it's all mixed in there. So there's so much to get ready. But I am excited. I'm really looking forward to getting on the stage. But of course, getting on stage and performing, there's always that, what they call, I love the word in French, le trac. I don't even know what it means, really. Stage fright is like really, really literal. But there's just something, you know, where you don't know what it is. It's the unknown still.
Something really neat is that one of your performances is going to be accessible to people with partial or full visual impairment, I believe. Tell me more about that.
This is a really exciting project, and it's the first time in Canada, not with me. I'm the second. The first time was with Alan Lake about a month ago. This team that is doing it, it's just so interesting. So what it will be is, I've been working with them. They've been going through the video in detail. They've asked me a lot of questions. And so they're building a way to really describe it. They will be live. So they will be behind stage, backstage, with cameras and screens, and they will be following the performance. So it will be a live performance for the visually impaired. And what I find really exciting about this is that it's dance. So it's kinetic and it's very visual. But what I find really exciting about bringing it to visually impaired or completely non-seeing people, people that cannot see at all, what I find really exciting about this is, yes, to describe what's going on so they're listening, but they're also going to feel the vibration of the music. They're able to hear in over through the écouteur, the hearing aid, they'll be able to hear and feel the music. And I believe, because that's why we dance, is they're going to be feel the transmission of the energy. So I'm really excited to see how it's received. They've already done it once, as I said. I wasn't there for that one. I'm really excited to talk to them after. It's Enora Rivière, Georges Nicolas Tremblay, and Audrey Anne Bouchard. And it's organized with Densité and Montréal Art Interculturel.
I'm familiar with Audrey Anne Bouchard. She's quite an exceptional person.
Really?
The one last thing I wanted to ask you about is something we discussed a year ago, which is that, you know, you created this piece for your 60th year. You've been in dance for decades, but you also have experience with other forms of performance and body work, martial arts, yoga. You're a very talented person. This is your first solo show, which is remarkable, I think, to a lot of people. So what message do you want or hope that you're, you know, putting on this big show at this age sends to artists, to other artists?
What I think is really important is to see people of all ages. If they have something to say, if they're working hard to hone in on the perfectionism of their art, even though we know it can never be perfect. And without being masochistic perfectionist, because we know that can be masochistic, but to really want to refine the communication of something through art. I don't believe there's an age for that. Dance is a physical medium. So of course there's a limitation. However, I believe in the power of, if you have grandmothers, I didn't have a grandmother, but I didn't have both my grandmothers actually. But if you've worked with older people, which I have, and I was with my father until he was very old, the smallest of gestures can be important. However, yes, because I am a dancer, I'm still working physically quite hard. There's things that I won't do. I don't do, you know, certain things that might hurt me. But I still feel quite strong. The message, I think, is what I started off with. I think that really there are amazing people. I'm not a really well-known dancer, so I don't have that behind me. And I think it's amazing that I'm able to be able to present this at this age. However, there are people, older dancers, that are continuing. There's Louisa Cavalier, who is our national phenomenon. But I think that it's really important to be able to see in dance, in this art form, someone of this age perform and communicate and use the art.
Heather, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really appreciate it.
Such a pleasure, Sarah.
That was Heather Ma, the creator and performer of Pomegranate at the Mai. She opens her first show tonight, and you can catch her through the weekend. For tickets and more information, visit mai.qc.ca, that's mai.qc.ca, or call 514-982-3386, located at 3680 Jean Mons in the Plateau. The 2 p.m. matinee on Saturday, December the 4th, will offer in audio description for the visually impaired. Blind and partially sighted audience members will receive live narration by two audio describers from Montreal's Danse Cité. This is a first for a dance show happening in the city, and this is only the second time that this has been done in Canada. You will need a smartphone and a headset, and if you don't have one, the theater will provide it. The ticket price for that show is reduced to $20 for those who are blind or partially sighted, and accompanying persons can attend for free. Also of note, Friday's show will be followed by a talkback with the audience. I'm really excited for this show, and I hope you get an opportunity to check it out. I'm Sarah DeA, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Still to come, two dancers, partners on the stage, bring their desire to dance and think outside the box to Tangente, to the beat of techno music straight from Berlin. It's 1970. American writer Richard Bach has published his novella, Jonathan Livingston Seagull. Within 2 years, over a million copies are in print, and the story has remained popular ever since, an allegory about seeking out perfection and demanding more from life. Our hero is a seagull, Jonathan, who gets bored with the humdrum of the everyday search for food and squabbling, and he risks the ire of his community when he strives to do more and be more than just an ordinary seagull. Two local theater companies have teamed up to recraft the story for a young audience, with a bonus added message of the limits and liberation that come with our bodies and communities. It's a special production because it features actors with physical disabilities playing key roles on stage. They also inspired and developed the work over time. Surreal So Real Theater is the new company in residence at Fred Barry Hall, part of Théâtre Denis Pelletier in Hochelaga. And its director, John Lachlan Stewart, has written and directed Jonathan, A Seagull Parable. They have teamed up with Geordie Theater for this ongoing, inclusive, bilingual production. John was originally inspired by Youssef Kadoura, a graduate from the National Theatre School who lives with a disability, and feels his experience imbues deeper layers of meaning to his work. He and other members of the cast are also differently abled, including Prince Aponza and famed dancer and choreographer Luca Lazy Legs Pacciuelli, who performs with his crutches. They are joined by actress Leslie Velasquez, who is originally from Mexico and has been performing and working in Montreal for nearly a decade. I spoke with Leslie last week. You're going to love it when you hear the enthusiasm in her voice for this production. Leslie, welcome to Upstage. Thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you for being here. How are you today?
I'm very good. A bit tired, but I'm good. Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
When we are speaking, you will have just done your first preview performance last night. How was the reception? How did people react?
I think it was a very rock and roll. It was a very high speed adrenaline. And I think the reception was really good. I really felt blessed. It was a full house, and I don't know, I heard people laughing all along. So yeah, it was very good.
Hearing laughter is always a good sign.
Yeah.
So this play was developed with a company that is in residence right now at the Fred Barry Hall, Surreal So Real Theater. And so it's actually been in development for quite a little while now before Geordie came on the scene and before obviously rehearsals began. At what point in the process did you get involved?
From the very beginning, if I'm not mistaken, there was an open call, actually. John was an open call for interpreters who wanted to really get involved in the research process. It was a very clear research process, open call, you know. There was not a date to perform or anything. So, but he had clear what story. And so, and I was like, yeah, I want to see that. But I didn't know John by that time. I didn't know him. So I really Google him, as many people do. And then I really started like seeing his work. And I was like, yeah, I want to work with that guy. I want to work with, because that's how I personally start making professional links in Montreal, because I'm not from here. So I try to see as much as possible my peers' work, because I think it's important. And with John, I didn't have the chance to work with him before. So this was a great opportunity to get to know him better. So, yeah.
Now, the play incorporates performers who live and work with disabilities. You're not one of them, but I think one of the messages of the play and the production is that, you know, we can be inclusive and include people of all different walks of life and different backgrounds. What is your perspective being on the cast now and getting into the performances of what it's like for the performers who do perform with disabilities and why this kind of show is so remarkable?
At first I was like very concerned or curious about, what does that mean? What message do we want to pass and blah, blah, blah. Honestly, at the end of the day, we are interpreters, like doing our work. And the thing is, like Yusuf mentioned that in one of our videos for promotional videos, he's like, this is the society we live in. It's not any extraordinary thing, you know. It's really what we are part of a society. There's so many things that we don't know that are happening, and people with disabilities are there, as well as immigrants, as well as refugees, as well as, you know, like people who suffer violence, like, I don't know. And the thing is, like, the theme of the play talks about that, the differences between us and why we cannot get together to get to an understanding. In working, you got to get an agreement at some point. You have to work. So to me personally, I've been a bit shy because I want to learn more about that. I see that a normal building in general, other than a passage for a wheelchair, it's not made for people with disabilities. It's just not made for it. You know, in general, I'm not talking about Fred Barry, you know, it's in life. It's just a reflection. I'm not against anything. It's just our life. We are not aware. So what brings me to work in this show, it's an awareness. And I see how, like, people without disabilities, we feel ignorant. We feel shy. We feel like, I don't know how to address this, you know? And sometimes, you know, they are a lot more relaxed than us because they know their reality a bit better. But at the same time, it's because there's this weird barrier that it's there, but at the same time, it's not there. It's product of our interaction as a society. So, yeah.
I'm speaking with Leslie Velasquez, who's one of the performers, and Jonathan is Siegel Parable on now at the Théâtre Fred Barry. And I think you put it so well, which is just once you put it into your mindset about inclusivity and how to bring everybody on board, you start to see the inequities everywhere where we are still missing. And this project is just, you know, one step forward to kind of advancing that narrative and hopefully educating children and families as well as regular audience members. So let's get into the story. Jonathan is Siegel Parable. Can you tell me a little bit about the original story, which is so well known for many readers of the book who kind of really identify with this story, but maybe let's all just start off on the same page. What is the story of Jonathan Siegel?
Yeah, well, the original story, I don't really remember which year was like came out, like 70s or something. It's by Richard Bach's novel. It was like a huge international bestseller for so long, even now. Like it really went through generations. It was translated. And my parents, like my father at least knows the story in Spanish. Is they put a name on it. I mean, Jonathan, but it was called like Juan Salvador Gaviota, which I don't know why Salvador, but whatever. Juan Salvador Gaviota, I think.
Is Gaviota a seagull?
Yeah, okay. Gaviota. And at least in Latin America was a very, I learned that later, like from people from my dad's generation or my mom's generation were like, I mean, they were really aware of this story. And basically it's a seagull. It's everything is a metaphor, of course. And story of a seagull that really wants to fly in a way. Physically, he's not supposed to. So he's actually daring nature in general, and not only the society or the system around it, but nature. Like he wants to really go as like and like span the wing as a sparrow when he's not supposed to, you like sparrow and a seagull, you know. And then everything is like also translated into a father and son relationship and society. It's actually a micro way of relationship in a family, and then that becomes a macro, you know, like really how family is the base of our society and how we can respect our differences and still be us, right? And then how that really reflects of how society works in general. And it's and this is the hero thing. It's, you know, Jonathan, it's not happy, so I gotta go out of here. So he leaves, and then he finds people as good and as happy and as available to do and curious like him. And then he realizes that we have this spiritual ego world, you know, that sort of it seems to work sort of the same, right? I want to go back and teach my peers about this. You know, this is possible. Maybe I can. Why are you going there? You're good here. Why are you trying to do something different again? So there are clans. There are, you know, there are like little bunch of, circles. It's not only a cycle, but circles.
Circles of connection, I guess.
Yeah. And then finally he comes back and things don't work as he thought, because you know what, there's never a way to do one thing. And the beauty of this is everything comes to, will ever my dad accept me, will ever be able to leave, even if the person I admire the most never accepts me, but that doesn't mean the person doesn't love me.
It's profound stuff.
It's really big. It's funny because it's told in a very funny way. That's the original story. I mean, there's a lot of it. I read the novel actually way before, like 2 years ago or something. So I barely remember some details, but the fact that John Lachlan's story put it on stage is another whole thing. So
yeah, well, let's talk about a little bit about the production, how it ends up looking. I'm speaking with Leslie Velasquez, one of the performers of Jonathan, a Seagull Parable, on now at the Salle Fredberry Hall. So how does this get adapted for, most importantly, like a children's audience, right? And incorporates, you know, the fact that we have performers with disabilities in the show. There's an added layer about inclusion and making people get included and felt and be part of a community.
Well, I think I would think of two things, maybe three.
Okay.
not exactly in the order or right. Before. Humor. Humor. Like, you know, we try to make jokes or but not make jokes. There's a humor sense in it, like the way to tell the story that's already profound. So there's humor. And I would say the visual, like the plastic, the image, the imaginary coming out of the beautiful conception, the costumes by Sophie Al-Assad. So it's really, and Tiffany's lighting design. Really, it's really, wow, you know? So visually, it's already really, I don't know. You really want to see it, I think.
Yeah, it's impressive.
yeah. And then I would say the physical work. Sometimes there's no words. When you have no words and you try to make the story clear, unless you do like explicit sexual content, it's actually very attractive to any audience when there's no words, you know, because it gives a, I think it lets the space, the room for interpretation on a frame. But you want to know what they would be saying if they would be speaking, right? Like there's this thing that happens with physical theater that a gesture can like become or mean something, a lot of things, you know. That's what I think. And well, the story, it's a person who's trying to challenge his dad, like the relationship with the authority, pretty much.
I do want to ask about Luca Lazy Legs, who is a well-known choreographer here in Montreal and a figure in disability inclusion and activism as well. So how does his work add another layer to the show? Are you doing a lot of dancing yourself in the show?
He's dancing, yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, many of the choreographed parts are were orchestrated by him. Like he was doing the research and deciding which movements would be good, proposing that to John. John was like, okay, this. But we did a lot of research. Like we did such an amazing work and choreography throughout the process that we cannot see it now. But he did a lot of it. And the most important thing, he had to really be open and receptive to everybody's way to relate with a crutch, you know, with the crutches. So it's quite particular. It's quite particular how your whole body or whatever the way of your body is, it's going to relate with that object and make it or turn into a plasticity that's gonna mean something for the show. And well, he's just amazing and he can do things that no one can. And he has such an energy and he's always bringing up the awareness of, yeah, the meaning of such a significant object, but also just go for it, you know? And he always says that no excuses, no limits. And he's awesome.
Well, it sounds like he's an integral part of the choreography and I cannot wait to see the performance itself. Leslie, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Yeah, no, thank you, Sarah. Thank you for the invitation. I hope I was clear enough for, yeah, that the audience can come and see us. We would be so glad to see us. Good to see you, sorry.
That was Leslie Velasquez, who is currently performing in Jonathan, A Siegel Parable. It's a new bilingual show for teens and families by Surreal Surreal Theater and Geordie Theater. It's on now until December 11th at Hall Fredberry, or Fredberry Hall, which is located in the Théâtre Denise Pelletier, 4353 St. Catherine Street West. Tickets and information, visit geordie.ca, geordi.ca. I'm Sarah DeA, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Our next conversation, two dancers who met in school say their working relationship enables them to push each other like no one else. Julia Villaperrière and Sébastien Provencher will perform in a two-hander that they have choreographed. It's the final show of Tangente's fall season, and it's titled What Will Come. Both artists say they intended to step outside the box in a world that attempts to categorize and label everything. And literally, boxes emerge to clutter the stage as they ramp up the action. There's a frenetic pace to the show, there's a big concept behind it, but that's not the exact initial plan they set out with when they started working on the show back in 2016. As you will find out, What Will Come is an example of how artists adapt their thinking and inspiration over time. I spoke with Julia and Sébastien last week.
Bienvenue, Julia and Sébastien, to Upstage. Thank you so much for being here today. Tell me, what's your morning been like so far? What have you been working on with the show today?
Hi, yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. So this morning we were working more specifically on lighting and costumes, so to make sure that the show has the right look, a great aesthetic, and yeah, it was very exciting.
This is your second piece that you've been working on together, but I'm curious about how your relationship started as, you know, your working relationship. Mm-hmm. What do you like about collaborating with one another? Whoever wants to take that first, yeah. No pressure.
Well, we met each other when we were doing our degree in contemporary dance at UQAM in Montreal, and we've been like in the same class. So we've been working like as I was dancing for Julia, and then we did some collaboration and we decided to create a piece together in 2015. Yeah. So we've been working on one piece and this is the second piece we've been working together. So there's a lot of pleasure in us, in between us and working together. And there, it's really, we see the work as something more horizontal where we have both our ideas and sometimes, Julia's ideas like are stronger than mine or mine are stronger, so we decide so what's the best for the piece in the end. So we have a lot of pleasure working together. I don't think we would have been working together for so long if it wasn't like
so nice. So yes, nice.
Yeah,
what's interesting for me is also that you know, working together allows us to both try stuff that are a bit outside of our comfort zone. So we push each other to try new things and new ideas. And the piece we made, you know, it wouldn't be really a piece that Seb would do or that I would do. It's really the marriage of our both artistic tastes and practices. Yeah.
You're each pushing each other forward to try new things.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Do you ever think about the sheer chance of it that you would end up in the same class or, you know, be in the same program in the same year, and that, you know, from that connection, you would have this fruitous collaboration for years to come. It's kind of wild.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's like it was meant to be. You know, they say this like about weddings and stuff. Like, I totally feel that Sébastien is like my artistic husband.
Yeah, we've been like playing with this for...
We're a bit polyamorous, but you know, in the end.
You're not completely committed to each other, but there is this this thing that draws you back together each and every time.
Yeah, and this artistic, like, yeah, practice. And there's also a pleasure, like, of us creating the piece and being also in the piece. Like, the two pieces we did were like that. So, basically, we're, like, performing and creating, so it creates a lot of different levels of like investments in the work, and it's quite a good challenge for us and to create the piece and try to see how it generates like things in our bodies when we're in it.
Do you think the nature of dance work and maybe the nature of the work you're trying to do as well within contemporary dance, is it helped by having a close collaborator? Like,
I think to create together, you have to trust a lot, even to a certain point. I mean, you have to trust a lot. And through dance, you trust with your body, you touch each other. So to be with someone you are comfortable with allows a lot more freedom. Mm-hmm. So by collaborating together for so long, we can be very playful in the explorations we try. We can try things that fail. We can really go for it in a way, in a safe working space. Yeah.
I'm speaking with Julia Bilaparrière and Sébastien Provencher about their coming show, Will Come, What Will Come. I wanted to ask about, I've seen the trailer and I wanted to ask about the set because I think that ties into the message and what you're working with. There's a lot on stage. I wouldn't say cluttered. We're looking at a white space. There are boxes, there are objects, you interact with them. Tell me a bit about how that kind of leads into your message and, you know, why you wanted to have these objects on stage with you.
At first, when we started the piece, we were really interested about how much we're like, as human beings, really focus on like creating boxes and creating like things that for us go together, and like how much there's an obsession about like creating boxes in our world to be able to evolve in the world we live in. So we decided to literally take boxes and see and explore from that, like what does it generate to just move boxes and move objects, and how much like this relationship with the object that is really squared, how much it changes something in the body, and what it generates also as a movement. So the scenography is mostly like white boxes and or black or like objects from like daily living or stage objects. So it's like things that we explore how these creates sounds, these objects create movements and generates movements also in our bodies.
And it's interesting too, because in seeking to, you're talking about boxes, so categorizing things and trying to make sense of the world, we want to line things up, put them aside. That's a very natural inclination, but you're also getting a little bit more at trying to make sense of the state of the world and the chaos we're living in. So are you trying to make a pointed commentary about what's going on right now in the world? This kind of leads into when you started making the show. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A different time. Even, it's crazy to say it, but just even 5 years ago was a different time. So walk me through maybe like what you were trying to make sense of back in 2016 and what that's kind of evolved to now in 2021.
Yes, so I think we started making the show really from the square perspective. So with this idea of boxes and categorization and labels, as queer bodies, we experiment this a lot in our daily living. And we were trying to question a bit this obsession of categorization. And it's necessary to apprehend the world, but we were like, thinking what are other options or how can we live within this, but also question it, make it evolve. And now I think we've been through a pandemic, we're in the midst of an ecological crisis. And for us, I think it's very interesting to see how the material of the piece has evolved and gained different readings through these events, because we are very much at the start trying to contain our environment, organize it, keep it under control. And there's a moment in the piece where the environment just kind of takes over, takes us over, takes our bodies over. And the question is, out of this chaos, how can we take the opportunity to sort of propose a new world or propose new options?
Mm-hmm. And how much, like, we in the piece, we were a lot talking about, like, if something is more circular or like less square, like, does it create something? Also, or like if the body's really squared, and then how can this like new way of being in connection with our environment can generate something else in the body also. So from this like exploration from order to chaos, what's next? What comes? What will come after?
So it's both a question and a hypothesis in a way. And our hypothesis as dancers, of course, goes towards a bit returning to the senses, the body, the touch, the importance of the other also.
I do want to remark quickly that there's a lot of frenetic energy in the show. It's busy.
What is that? I don't know what you're talking about.
How hard is that hard on your body?
Well, Seb is more in shape, but I'm like, oh my God, I have to train.
I feel it can be hard, but it's also, this week we've been working a lot on this, and next week is like going to be a challenge also to see how much we can create this vibration we want to create without hurting our bodies and without giving too much. So then we can sustain, like it's impossible to keep on working this way for so long. So how can we challenge our bodies and time and playing also together, like Julia has more energy and then I'm lower and then we switch. So then we keep this idea of vibration. What we want to do is like make the space vibrate. So also the body gets some vibration, but it's always like shaking is always like knowing how to do it without giving too much energy. So it's always a challenge of like muscle tone, how you move, where the movement comes. So then you can create this idea that it's really intense, but in your body you can live with it and
yeah, you can sustain it. Mm-hmm. And of course, like this is very much where the choreography and the choreographic tools come in, but of course we want to raise the energy and the vibration also with the music and the lights in a way that it contaminates the audience. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'm speaking with Julia B. Laparrière and Sébastien Provencher, What Will Come, presented by Tangente Danse this month. You'd mentioned the music. Let's address that because you have a composer who's based in Berlin coming all the way here to do live music, which is really cool. I think their name is pronounced Deep New. Is that correct?
Yeah, in German it's Deep New. So it's like Deep New, and he's Braulio Bandeira. Passport name, I don't know.
Yes, official name versus artistic nom de plume. Tell me about how you came to collaborate with them as a choreographer.
I first met Braulio on a contract in Germany as a performer, a dancer, and then he became kind of a DJ in the Berlin nightlife. And for us, I think it was interesting to collaborate with, we wanted to work with techno music, and it was interesting to collaborate with someone who also has a knowledge about the dancing scene and the dancing body.
And also in the show, he's some sections, he's really doing the music live, and he's on stage a bit on the side, but we can feel his presence also. So for us, it was important to have somebody that also can follow what's going on stage and can really be with us and be sensitive to dancers, because he has been a dancer. He's still a dancer, but like professionally he's more doing music. So having someone that has this perspective was for us really fun. And the way the piece is built, it's really important that we have live music, because it gives us energy, and it's all, there's also a connection that we can create with sound, less with him, but with sound, what sound generates in the space and what it generates in our bodies. So we decided that music is live, and there's also lighting from Nicola Dubois that is also, some sections are also live, like depending of where we are, there's like shifts and it changes depending of what we're doing on stage.
That must add so much nuance to the show, but it adds so many more details for you as well to have mm-hmm. the music and the lighting be done live. Is it intimidating at all?
For us, I think it's a great pleasure because, you know, when you rehearse a show for a long time, and if you perform it more than once, like the liveness of these elements keeps like triggering new things in us, and it keeps the show very much alive for us. And if you come on Thursday or if you come on Saturday, maybe you see two different shows, and I think that's very rich.
Mm-hmm. This is a very, I think, deep piece. There's a lot, I think, to think about. So what is one question you hope your audience members take with them when they leave after seeing What Will Come?
We were talking a bit about it this week. I think for me, it's less a question, but if feeling I want to give to the audience. I think there's something really, the sensory elements or sensorial are really important in the piece. So I think it's just giving like this sensorial experience watching the piece, because like lights are like important. The sound is like at some point overwhelming, or just like a really small detail. And we're playing with like the big elements and really like details in our bodies, in our, so I think there's something really sensorial about the piece that for me is like giving this thing to the audience to experience also as us performers on stage.
Yeah, and maybe to an impulse to a bit break free of these categories. What are mm-hmm. the categories that affect them and their lives? And how also we carry our bodies through these, like, you know, living in a city, being in cubes the whole day, like how does it affect the way we mm-hmm. are in our bodies and how we close ourselves? And if we can open this a little bit with the show, mm-hmm. for me, that would be great.
Giving more queerness to our world.
Queering the world and stepping out of our boxes. I'm all for it.
Yeah. While partying on techno music.
Yeah, and partying to techno music. We can't do all this without the techno music. Julia and Sebastian, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to speak with both of you.
Same, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Julia Villaparrière and Sébastien Prémanchet, choreographers and performers of What Will Come. The dance show is scored by Braulio Bandera, a Berlin-based composer also known as Deep Nu. You are hearing some of his work right now, and Bandera is in town to perform alongside Julia and Sébastien. It opens in just a few minutes from now at Tangente and continues through the weekend. For tickets, call 514-525-1500 or visit Tangente Danse .ca, located at 1435 de Blury. You have been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. Tonight you heard Heather Ma, who debuts Pomegranate tonight at the Mai, Leslie Velasquez in Jonathan, a Siegel Parable at Théâtre Fred Berry until December the 11th, and Julia B. Laparrière and Sébastien Provencher, co-creators and performers in What Will Come at Tangente starting in just a couple of moments from now. And I have recommendations for you if you're looking for something to do this weekend. It's your last chance to check out All I Want for Christmas at Centaur Theatre. It is a really fun romp by Rebecca Northen about a troublesome, well, an elf who doesn't quite fit into the regular jobs at the North Pole. But she gets a last minute chance to work in the mailroom right before Christmas Eve, and then a mysterious package shows up. I really enjoyed the show. It's a lot of fun. It's not for kids, and it's a good distraction. You'll enjoy it. Superdog the musical has also opened at the Siegel Center this week. That involves the story of a young girl who takes her dog, who was adopted from the SPCA, and she believes she has what it takes to make it on the show. There's a live band, there's singing, and there's tons of dogs on stage. That's at the Siegel Center until the 19th of December. Also, Silence of Sky, final weekend to check that out at Infinite Theater. It's a mime piece. It's about the experience of living with family members who are on the Spectrum, performed by Anana Ridvald. Fantastic piece from what I'm hearing. And tonight, if you're in at home and you're looking for something interesting, the annual Die Hard, the all-woman live read is back. It's directed by Terrence Bowman, formerly of On the Spot. He's a performer and improviser, and he directs an all-star cast of local funny ladies and a live online performance. You can catch it on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch. The event is free, and they accept donations for the Canadian Women's Foundation. I really loved last year's reading of the Bruce Willis movie. Die Hard is considered a Christmas classic, even though there's lots of explosions. And it's a very tongue-in-cheek and creative way of interpreting the movie with just people performing on Zoom. So Dina Aziz, Dawn Ford, Adina Katz, Sehar Manji, just some of the performers. If you can't see it live tonight, it's going to be up on all three platforms, Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, for 24 hours after tonight. And this is happening within the next hour or so. You can visit Canadian Women .org for more information. Please listen to past episodes of Upstage at CKUT.ca under our archives. A very big thank you to Jack Solar, our spoken word coordinator, for making sure this show gets to air. And a very big thank you for tuning in tonight. I'm your host, Sarah Day. Speak with you next time on Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. Have fun and stay safe. Up next is Grey Matters.
Cyclorama Tour. Polo and Pan. December 11th, Place Belle. One night only in Montreal. Get tickets now at evenco.ca. Polo and Pan, Cyclorama Tour.
If you have flu-like or COVID-19-like symptoms, such as fever, cough, loss of taste or smell, or if you have been in contact with someone infected with the virus, it's essential to get tested and to follow isolation instructions, even if you're vaccinated. Screening remains one of the best ways to limit outbreaks. To find out more, visit quebec.ca/test COVID-19. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.